All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry. I was a Chief Warrant Officer in the United States Army, helicopter type pilot in 1969 in 3 Corps in Vietnam. So I want to welcome you to our program. We're going to be jumping way ahead and back today. I'm really excited about today's program. We're going to be talking with a couple of people who were stationed in the Mideast and were part of the hunt for the caliphate. That, the battle to eliminate ISIS in Iraq and Syria. And you got to stick around for this. We're going to be talking about information that only we will know when we're done today. It's all hush hush, but it's not secret. It's all been cleared, trust me. But I'm really excited to talk to the two gentlemen that will be on in just a little bit. But first off, we are going to take a little step back, not quite as far back as it seems like for when I was flying. Probably beyond that. But the Yankee Air Museum is coming up with their Thunder Over Michigan program, and this is coming up on the weekend of August 3rd. And joining me on the line right now is the Executive Director of the Yankee Air Museum, and that's Kevin Walsh. Kevin, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Dale. Pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm really excited to talk about the program, too. So what is going on this year at Thunder Over Michigan?
Well, it's a special show. It's our 21st anniversary show. If you can believe, we've been around for 21 years doing this this marquee event in Southeast Michigan. This year, it's the world's largest gathering of Corsairs, one of the most famous fighters of World War II and the Korean era. We are gathering the largest number of those since the Korean War together to salute this magnificent machine and those that maintained and flew it.
Well, I think if everybody who looks at World War II movies, especially the aircraft carriers and stuff, these are the planes that had the fold-up wings, right?
Yes, correct. With the gull wing, or what commonly referred to as the bent wing design. Of course, that design was all in purpose to help have the clearance for the propeller and to land on the aircraft carrier. Mm-hmm. This is a very, very famous fighter. Of course, a lot of folks remember it from the old TV program, Baba Black Sheep, right. Featuring Robert Conrad. And those were the days where they had multiple aircraft like that flying in the TV show. And we haven't seen that for many, many, many years. So we like to do these salutes. We like to stand out amongst the warbird world and do things that are really different. It's very difficult to get all the owners and operators together for these salutes, but we're one of the few events in the world that does it.
Yeah, that's pretty exciting, but you've got even more, right?
That's right. Yeah. Yep, absolutely. We'll have Air Combat Command's F-16 demo coming this year. There's no shortage of noise when the F-16 flies. Of course, we've got on the civilian side of the house, we have the jet-powered biplane, Screaming Sasquatch, with John Clatt Air Shows, and then also Red Bull Air Racer Michael Goulian is coming to do his solo aerobatic routine. So you actually get to see one of these Red Bull Air Race guys doing his thing out there, too.
Is this the guy that goes straight up in an old biplane and then falls out of the sky?
So that's Screaming Sasquatch, and they do that. They go up, they bleed off all their airspeed, and then just let the airplane drop in what's called a hammerhead turn, where they turn the aircraft around and kick the rudder in and point it back towards the Earth, diving straight down at the Earth. But this one has a big jet engine hung on the bottom of a propeller-driven airplane. Weirdest thing you've ever seen.
I can't wait to see that. I can't wait to see that. So there are other things, too, going on. I understand that you can get some rides in some of these aircraft.
Absolutely. Well, the Yankee Air Museum will be flying all four of their vintage aircraft, our B-17 World War II bomber. Of course, there's only about 10 of those in the world flying. Only 5 of them give rides. Our combat veteran B-25 Mitchell bomber from World War II, very rare to actually get a ride in something that did participate in the war. This one actually flew 8 bombing missions in Corsica. Mm. Our C-47 World War II transport and our open cockpit Waco biplane. You'll be able to fly in all of those. And in addition, we have two Huey helicopters and a Cobra helicopter from the Vietnam era also giving rides.
I am excited about that one. Not that they'll ever let me sit in the cockpit again, but I can't wait to see that, especially a Cobra. I've never been in a Cobra, so I'm excited to try that. So when is this going to be held?
So it's held August 3, 4 at Willow Run Airport, home to the Yankee Air Museum. Everything that you need to know about the event, you go on yankeeairmuseum.org, and you can find tickets there. You can find out information about the museum, about the rides on the aircraft. Really, it's one of the rare shows where you get to actually come and attend a show and that you can actually fly in a vintage aircraft too while you're attending the show.
Oh, I know. I've been there many times, and it's a great show, and you're going to be talking all about warbirds this time, and people are going to be able to take rides, and there's a great static display as usual, I'm assuming.
Yep, absolutely. We have over 30 modern military aircraft, over 40 vintage military aircraft. So you're looking at over 70 aircraft, which is a very large number for any air show these days. But, you know, we don't forget why we do what we do, and we stick to primarily saluting the military of past and present, because that is the way we educate folks on what our veterans have done for our country, from those that have served to those that have given the ultimate sacrifice. This is a way to connect. It's the conduit to both the past and to our present military serving today. You can't walk up an airbase and knock on the door and go in and thank those that serve our nation, maintain our aircraft, and also fly our aircraft and do the missions they do. Air shows, and in particular Thunder Over Michigan, is that conduit between the military and the general public. And this is a chance that you really don't get any other time other than, you know, at Thunder Over Michigan.
Well, that's absolutely true. So that's August 3rd and 4th. And go to yankeeairmuseum.org for all the information, tickets, ticket prices, and so forth. And we'll see you all there, I hope.
Excellent. Thank you, Dale.
All right. Thank you very much, Kevin. All right. We're going to take a quick break, but I got to remind everybody here that we have sponsors here that allow us to come on the radio station here in Ann Arbor. Number one would be Legal Help for Veterans, which specializes in veterans' disability claims. For more information, you can go to their website, which is Legal Help for Veterans, or you can give them a call at 800-693-4800. Number two is U.S. Wings, and U.S. Wings are the manufacturers of the finest leather flight jackets, speaking of World War II type of jackets, yes. They're a major supplier of leather flight jackets for the military. For more information, you can go to their website as well, that's uswings.com, or give them a call at 800-650-0659. Oh, and I have to remind you, every month we have been giving away one of their leather jackets here on Veterans Radio, and we will be doing that again next week on our benefits program. So go to our website, veteransradio.net, and there'll be a big button there that says sign up to see if you can win the jacket. The only qualification is that you have served in the military at some point. So we want you to do that. And also I want to thank our local veteran service organizations for their sponsorship. That's the American Legion Post 46, VFW Post 423, and the Charles S. Kettles Vietnam Veterans of America Post 310, all of Ann Arbor, Michigan. So we're going to take a real quick break right now, and when we come back, we're going to be talking with our two guests about hunting the caliphate. You got to listen to that. This is going to be good. We'll be right back.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
And welcome back to Veterans Radio. I'm your host, Dale Thronberry, today, and I have the privilege of having two incredible warriors on our program. One is a retired Major General from the United States Army, that's Dana Pittard, and hopefully that I'm not misspelling or mispronouncing your names. And the other is an Air Force Master Sergeant, retired as well, Wes Bryant, and I'm going to start with the General. So, General Pittard, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Oh, thank you, Doug. Thank you very much.
The name of your book is Hunting the Caliphate. Am I pronouncing that correctly, Caliphate?
You are.
Okay. I was getting myself all flustered when I was trying to remember how to pronounce that word. So give us a little background on you and how you've spent almost 30 years in the military, retiring as a major general.
Yes, I did. I spent 34 years in the military and deployed to combat many times. And the book, Hunting the Caliphate, is centered around the initial fight against ISIS. And if you remember back in the summer of 2014, June 2014, ISIS attacked Iraq. And ISIS was a terrorist organization, and they took a third of Iraq's territory. They took the second largest city in Iraq, Mosul, and portions of Syria. So within 2 weeks of their invasion of Iraq, I was called forward to lead a small group into Baghdad to help secure the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad, as well as U.S. property and personnel that were there in Iraq, and then to really assess the situation. Wes Bryant, who is a Special Ops Air Force JTAC, that stands for Joint Terminal Attack Controller, was a part of the Special Ops group that also came in.
I was amazed when I read your book. And Wes, I want to welcome you to the program as well. Thank you for putting this together. And I learned so much, and that's why I think it's so important for our audience to be able to listen closely today, because we're going to be talking about situations that we didn't read about in the news a whole lot. And I think that that's what's so important about this program. Wes, tell us a little bit about yourself, and I know that you did multiple tours as well.
Yeah, as Dana touched on, I was a Joint Terminal Attack Controller under what's called the Air Force Tactical Air Control Party. So we're the guys that go out on the ground with both conventional and special operations forces and control and coordinate all the airstrikes that go on, that we hear about on the news and that we don't.
Mm-hmm. And this was a profession, I guess you could say, that these you were working with all the different services. I mean, this seems like it was a very inter-service connected type of mission.
Oh, yeah. We have, among the services, we have JTAC qualified SEALs. We have JTAC qualified Green Berets. We have another career field in the Air Force, which is it's kind of a goofy relation or scenario, I can say. We have two JTAC career fields in the Air Force, one, mine, being the Tactical Air Control Party, or TACP.
Mm-hmm.
The other one being the Combat Control Team, or CCT. We both do the same thing when it comes to controlling airstrikes. CCT have the additional duty of doing forward air traffic control, so they're charged with seizing airfields, going in and bringing in the first aircraft to set up a forward airbase.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to get into that when we talk about when you guys came into Iraq and set up an airfield in an hour, or it seems like something like that. Going back to Dana, I'm going to ask you if you could give us a little background, a little bit more on what ISIS is or was, and how, you know, we left Iraq in 2011. So how did we get pulled back in?
In fact, ISIS was formed from the remnants of the old al-Qaeda in Iraq that U.S. forces really beat as a part of the surge in 2007. So by the time U.S. forces left Iraq in 2011, most of al-Qaeda in Iraq was, or AQI as it was called back then, was on the run. But during the period of time that the U.S. forces left, it really gave AQI some breathing space, and in some ways they were able to reconstitute to an extent and help to form this large organization, ISIS. And ISIS was anti, but was part of the opposition groups to the Syrian president, President Bashar Assad. In fact, there were like over 1,200 different groups that were opposing him. When I was in Jordan in 2013, we were monitoring all sorts of groups, and one of them was ISIS. Mm-hmm. But ISIS quickly became one of the most dangerous, most organized, most lethal, and one of the larger organizations. They fought not only Bashar Assad, but also was determined to fight the Shia-led government in Iraq. So ISIS began to grow in 2012, 2013, and then first kind of reared its head in early 2014 by taking Fallujah. Most observers at the time thought, okay, the Iraqi army can handle them. But then when in June 9th, 2014, they attacked into northern and northeastern Iraq, northwestern Iraq, it caused a lot of concern because they took over Iraq's second largest city of Mosul. And they were a very barbaric group. They used al-Sharia as far as their law, Sharia law. And they then claimed the formation of the caliphate, which for many Muslims in the Middle East, that resonated to nearly over 1,000 years ago when there was a caliphate in that area.
Oh, right.
So that actually resonated with people. And actually people, even moderates, initially, in some ways, supported them until their barbaric behavior, how they were treating anybody they took over. If you weren't following their version of Islam, they would give you a choice to convert or kill you. And they were doing all sorts of barbaric things, beheading people. What they did to the Yazidis up in northern Iraq was very close to genocide.
Right. We're talking with Dana Pittard and Wes Bryant, the authors of Hunting the Caliphate, actually, which is America's War on ISIS and the Dawn of the Strike Cell, which we'll get into in a little bit. If you want to get in on the conversation out there, you can give us a call here on Veterans Radio at 734-822-1600. I wanted to talk a little bit about what you just mentioned, General, about the genocide in northern Iraq, because that seemed to be one of the big motivators to get us re-involved.
It did. In fact, the genocide against not only the Yazidi, but also many of the Kurds in northern Iraq. It was around Mount Sinjar or Sinjar Mountain that the first airstrikes against ISIS were authorized by President Obama. In fact, there was a period of time, and it's in the book, between June of 2014 and August of 2014, about a six-week period, where we're very frustrated because we wanted to start executing airstrikes against ISIS as soon as possible. But that time, we were not authorized to do that for many reasons. And again, those come out in the book also.
Right.
But it was some mistakes of ISIS that helped us to actually be able to create the opportunities to have those airstrikes. And one of them was the humanitarian operations centered around Mount Sinjar, when well over 20,000 Yazidis and Kurds were trapped on Mount Sinjar, which was surrounded by ISIS fighters. And we were able to then bring in airstrikes to support them. And then ISIS then turned around and made another strategic error, and that was to attack the Kurds and try to take over their capital of Erbil in August of 2014. And that's when the airstrikes began, and that's where Wes Bryant really came in, too.
I was going to just bring in Wes about that. Could you tell us, we've heard all of these things about drones and so forth, but we've never really witnessed what you gentlemen did, especially with the killing of those 80 people. Wes, can you describe what was going on when you first got there?
Well, what happened was Obama had set up this force called the CRIF. We refer to it as the CRIF. It's actually an acronym for the Crisis Response Force.
Mm-hmm.
That consisted of SEALs, Green Berets, Air Force Special Operators. Unfortunately, not the Marines. The Marines definitely have their place in our fights, but under the Special Operations Command, the Marines at that time were not aligning with the CRIF.
Mm-hmm. Well, I should point out to our listeners that that this was not a ground force. You know, you guys weren't going in there with troops and going in there, you know, full bore and taking them on that way. This was almost entirely an air war for you, especially Wes. And
it's interesting you say that. When we first went in, no one knew what it was going to be at all.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, my unit, this is in the book too, as you know, we were getting ready to go to our standard rotation, which was mostly concentrating in Afghanistan, a little bit of some operations in Africa as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I was actually getting ready to go to Afghanistan with a bunch of the other guys. We had been getting intel updates on ISIS for a couple of weeks, and we just thought it was this kind of fringe group. Okay, you know, nothing will come of it. And suddenly it just blew up, and, you know, I remember I got a call from my superintendent saying, hey, show up tomorrow, your mission's changed.
Mm-hmm.
So I go in, you know, the next day and they kind of split our team of guys going to Afghanistan versus now this new thing with ISIS, and then we had to pull a bunch of other guys from other units because we now needed to cover a whole other theater. And we weren't told much, not because it was secretive, because nobody knew. So it was, hey, you're going in. The only thing we knew was the CRIF is going in to secure Baghdad, specifically the embassy, the U.S. embassy, and the two capitals of Baghdad and Iraq, being the capital of Iraq, and then usually referred to Erbil as the northern capital of Kurdistan.
Mm-hmm.
And really, that was it. From there, it was a lot of chaos for quite a few weeks while the whole special operations component as well as General Pittard's command component there in the embassy was really all trying to figure out what we would end up doing on top of what ISIS was about and how strong they were, which we didn't actually know until we set foot on the ground.
Right. Well, General Pittard, you mentioned in the book, again, the book's title is Hunting the Caliphate, that there was a whole lot of political planning and politicizing that you had to do to get the Iraqis to actually fight back against ISIS.
Yes. In fact, when ISIS took over Iraq's second largest city, Mosul, they really basically destroyed the equivalent of five Iraqi divisions in doing that. And so morale with the Iraqi army and the leadership was pretty low when we showed up. In fact, they, in many ways, lacked the will to fight because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And ISIS had not only a strategic advantage, but they had almost like a moral advantage as far as a will to fight. And so it was really pushing the Iraqi senior military leadership to fight, along with our airstrikes. We said that the combination between their troops on the ground and our airstrikes was unbeatable as far as with ISIS, and that proved out to be correct. But when you say it was just an air war, it was much more than that. In fact, we had a lot of troops on the ground. They just weren't American troops.
Right.
The
coalitions.
Peshmerga, the Shia militias, and others that are part of it. And if you look at kind of the genesis of warfare in the region, look at Desert Storm, where there's well over 500,000 coalition troops on the ground, and you roll the tape forward to the surge in Iraq in 2007 that was successful, we had 165,000 troops on the ground. Well, when we were fighting ISIS, at least through the end of 2014, there weren't more than 1,500 American troops that were in support of that.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to stop what was thought to be the unstoppable offensive momentum of ISIS. We were able to put them on the defensive and have a number of successes against them, and making ISIS react to the Iraqi security forces as opposed to just the opposite. And then it took a couple more years to actually root out ISIS once we were put on the defensive. But even at the height of taking back Mosul in 2016, 2017, American forces on the ground were less than 10,000. Like, I think it was closer to 5,000 at that point with advisors and special ops.
Well, that's one of the interesting things that comes out in the book is how you had to negotiate with all these different coalition partners and, you know, to get them to head in one direction, because we all know, well, I can't speak as an expert, obviously, but, you know, we all know that there's a lot of tribalism that goes on in the Middle East. We've got about 2 minutes before we have to take a break. Could you address that just real quickly, General?
Oh, sure. We have a chapter even dedicated to it. It's literally like herding cats. and one point was the best hope was to keep them from fighting each other, much less to move forward and fight together in the same direction. But we were able to accomplish that in many ways. We had involvement from our political leaders, as well as just really being there for them. And like you said, in the meetings and everything else, and pushing the Iraqis to fight. It was a coalition that, which included Shia militias, which were backed by Iran, but there was a common enemy, and that was this barbaric insurgent organization, ISIS.
Well, we got to take a real short break here, but when we come back, we're going to be talking again with Major General retired Dana Pittard and Master Sergeant Wes Bryant. We're going to be talking about some of the missions that they were on when they were in Iraq back in 2014 through 2017. It's a great, great story. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back.
Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Sergeant First Class Paul Smith gave his life to protect his troops. Details after this.
On April 4th, 2003, a call went out for a place to put some Iraqi prisoners. Sergeant First Class Paul Smith volunteered to create a holding pen inside a walled courtyard. Soon, Iraqi soldiers, numbering perhaps 100, opened fire on Smith's position. Smith was accompanied by 16 men. Smith called for a Bradley, a tank-like vehicle with a rapid-fire cannon. It arrived and opened up on the Iraqis. The enemy could not advance so long as the Bradley was in position. But then, in a move that baffled and angered Smith's men, the Bradley left. Smith's men, some of whom were wounded, were suddenly vulnerable. Smith could have justifiably ordered his men to withdraw. Smith rejected that option, thinking that abandoning the courtyard would jeopardize about 100 GIs outside, including medics at an aid station. He manned a 50 caliber machine gun atop an abandoned armored personnel carrier and fought off the Iraqis, going through several boxes of ammunition. As the battle wound down, Smith was hit in the head. He died before he could be evacuated from the scene.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
And we're back on Veterans Radio. I'm your host today, Dale Thronberry, and joining us here on our program are Dana Pittard and Wes Bryant, and they are the authors of a new book that's just coming out in a week or so. It's called Hunting the Caliphate. It's America's War on ISIS and the Dawn of the Strike Cell. I'm going to talk first with General Pittard again real quickly. What is it that made ISIS so different than the other terrorist groups that we've been running into in the Middle East for so long?
One thing was their brutality, their strategic ambitions. Their ambitions went well past any other insurgent organization, including Al-Qaeda that we dealt with before. The fact that they declared a physical geographical country or state and named it the Caliphate was much different. And then their sheer barbaric nature and how they would go into towns and completely wipe out different populations that did not agree with their form of Islam, but truly very, very barbaric.
They, who supported them? Where did they get their financing and their money from and equipment?
Very interesting. Initially, many of their financing was from different Sunni nations that were out there, Saudi Arabia, other nations like that. The fact that one of the first places that they took over in Syria was in northeastern Syria, which is also where the Syrian oil fields were. Mm-hmm. So that also helped them as far as funding. They were the most well-financed terrorist organization that we have seen in decades, certainly. So that also helped. They were also very well organized, and I would say actually well led. You know, didn't like them, but they were well led. In fact, many of their leaders, even their senior leaders, would show up on the battlefield to encourage the ISIS fighters to move forward. So they're very courageous also.
Yeah, in the book, you mentioned how organized that they are, and you know that their tactics would evolve depending on, you know, what we would do to stop them and so forth, and that they were very flexible, I guess you could say, as far as that was concerned, but not quite flexible enough, I guess.
Right. They were also on social media quite a bit. At one point, they were tweeting 90,000 tweets a day, and they were on the airwaves, and they were recruiting in Western countries, including America, and they were doing that successfully for a while.
It's just amazing to me. I want to go back to you, Wes. Now, let's talk about what your job really is. This is something that really enlightened me and educated me. So what did you do as a JTAC? That's a Joint Terminal Attack Controller.
Mm-hmm. As an Air Force JTAC, I'm there. We coined this term, this another acronym, as you know.
Yeah.
The military loves acronyms. Advise, assist, and control is what we term it. The TACV community, which applies to really all JTACs, anyone performing the JTAC duty. There is an advisor to a maneuver ground commander, whether you're with an infantry unit, armor, special forces, SEALs, what have you. You're there as a liaison between ground and air, and then you're there as a controller to control that air power. And we control not only kinetic air power or air power that would kill or damage. We also control non-kinetic air power.
What is that?
In the case of drones looking for high-value targets, guiding a ground team to that target. In the case of some of these high-value raids that you hear about, sometimes mm-hmm. you know way after the fact, where we go after what we call high-value targets or those really high-level terrorist leaders.
Mm-hmm.
We also have other forms of non-kinetic coordination and control that, of course, I can't go into in depth here.
Right. No, I understand that. My question was leading toward this, that you make a lot of the decisions once the target has been targeted and approved as far as the weapons that are even used to take them out.
Oh, yeah. We are the voice of all air power, and I can say as well surface to surface, because as a JTAC on the ground, you're typically, especially in the special operations realm, where you are on a small team or in a small task force,
mm-hmm.
You are both the surface to surface indirect fires and then the air to surface fires expert and coordinator, and often we're the ones both finding the target in coordination with our intel or our ground sources. And advising on the best way to prosecute that target, be it if we're going to kill or attempt to capture. And we're the ones outside of strike cell operations that are down there with the teams and the ground units going with them forward to do these operations.
Mm-hmm. But what I found really interesting is in some of the chapters here where you were talking about some of the attacks that you were making is that you were telling them that you wanted a 500-pound bomb, you wanted a specific missile, you wanted specific ammunition used, and so forth. I was never aware of that.
Oh, yeah. It can be a very complicated game, and especially when we're talking about some of the most important aspects of being a JTAC outside of killing the enemy and keep him from killing your own people with airstrikes, what we call fratricide, mm-hmm. which is not causing undue collateral damage with your strikes and not killing civilians. It's huge for us. In fact, even to the point where we have formal collateral damage analysis training that either JTACs will go to and get certified, which I did through Central Command, or we'll have these collateral damage analysts with us either at a task force or available to us to run an analysis on a particular strike. In today's modern warfare, you know, it's so much different than how we waged war in the past, and I'm not going to knock how we did it. Those times were different, you know. But now, fortunately, with technology, we can truly wage war so much more ethically, if you will, mm-hmm. Where we can be precise. And that's where the JTAC comes in on the ground, is coordinating that precision to actually kill enemy targets, enemy fighters, and not kill anyone else.
And that's one of the points that I wanted to get out in this interview today, is that it's just not, you're not going to go blow up a whole village to take out one guy. You're going to, you know, you're based on your analysis of your information and so forth, you're going to try and actually find out where this one particular person is. You're not going to, you know, knock down all of the buildings. You're only going to try to go in the doorway of wherever this person is hiding.
Oh, yeah. And that will dictate what ordnance we use, whether we use a smaller bomb or even a missile to go mm-hmm. into the doorway, what trajectory we put that missile on, even what altitude we might launch it from, same with the bomb. And as you mentioned, the fusing of our mm-hmm. ordnance as well. You know, we can fuse all different ways to where we delay multiple different settings into the ground. We can have a bomb or a missile detonate instantaneously mm-hmm. or above the ground at some level, predetermined level. So there's just all kinds of options that give us that ability to combine, to kind of mesh the effects on the target with how much collateral damage we're going to cause or how much risk to civilians in the area or neutral parties we'll pose with that airstrike.
You went inside the book of Hunting the Caliphate. You talked about one mission where you took out a rather large patrol of ISIS people, and they kind of spread out, and your weapon that of choice on that particular day was you took out the guys at the front and you took out the guys at the back, and then you had to trace down the stragglers. Could you kind of describe to our audience, once you got a mission, what you had to do? What was the process that you would go through?
Gosh, it's...
I know it's time-consuming.
So, yeah, that's a good hard question, because it can be very complex, and then sometimes it can be really simple, just depending on the scenario. But first is clearing your air, coordinating all your players. Sometimes, you know, I've been in scenarios where I've had literally 20 players, what we refer to a player is an aircraft or a platform.
Okay.
20 players in a stack overhead an objective area that I am controlling, sometimes in coordination with one or two other JTACs. So that's first. Then you got to coordinate all your ground parties. So if you have U.S. forces on the ground, or in the case of Iraq and Syria, your forward partner forces, mm-hmm. often those were many different forces. Then we had neutral parties, and we had civilians to deal with. So you've got to, before anything happens, anything comes off that aircraft, you've got to know with reasonable assurity all of those factors. If you don't know where your friendlies are, if you have no idea if there are civilians in this particular building you're going to strike, you just don't do it in most cases.
And then once you find and locate the target, then you go upstairs to the general to get the approval, correct?
In the case of these strike cell operations, yes. When we're talking forward operations with U.S. forces on the ground, mm-hmm. which we have, by the way, still going a lot of going on in Afghanistan in particular. I mean, we're still losing.
Right, yeah, you were
losing guys weekly. But in the strike cell, yes, it was. If the general, who we call the target engagement authority, wasn't in, it was a group of us led by the senior JTAC, which I was when I would be on shift in a strike cell, targeting, looking for these ISIS fighters, these ISIS targets, either in coordination with a Iraqi ground movement or offensive, or just searching on our own if there wasn't a major offensive going on. Once we found a viable target, we had something going on, usually before it even got to that point where we knew, all right, it's time to strike, somebody would go get that target engagement authority, which in this case, in the case of early on in Iraq, was General Pattard.
General Pattard, I want to come back to you real quick because you were in the control room, and you know the way it was described in the book was that you know it had these huge monitors where you could see actually the live feed coming from the drones and so forth, but also the command back in the States, in Florida, and even the president could see potential targets while you're trying to decide whether to go after them or not. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, there was eight huge flat-screen TVs or monitors where we had a pretty good visual. Now, I'm not sure the president was watching it, but I assume that he could have. But certainly folks in the Pentagon at CENTCOM headquarters in Florida, as well as the CJTF headquarters in Kuwait, could also see. But yes, that's we had a pretty good view. You mentioned earlier the ground personnel from ISIS on that particular strike. I remember that like it was yesterday. There were 70, and they were actually suicide bombers because they had picked up their suicide backpacks in order to blow up different Iraqi positions. What was good about the strike cell is with our manned and unmanned aerial intelligence systems, we were able to actually track them and then strike them at what we thought was a really good time. So it was hitting them at the front, hitting them at the back, and hitting them in the middle, and then going after each of them, because each of them alone carrying their bomb packs were very dangerous. And you could, as you hit, you could see the secondary explosions from their backpacks also. And that's also in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's what I'm saying. People who are interested in this story, and it's something that you really should be interested in, you need to get a hold of this book and find out what these warriors were doing over there when we weren't even paying attention. And I think it's so important. And I guess I can kind of segue into there, General. What was our mission going back into Iraq? You know, I thought many people just assume, well, we're done with that place. Why did we go back?
Well, the mission initially and why I was sent with, at that time, just 100 personnel, was to, first of all, make sure that our embassy was secured. Remember, that was 2014. That was just 2 years after Tripoli when unfortunately, Ambassador Stevens was killed in Libya. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of concern at that time that ISIS was this juggernaut and unstoppable, that they were coming to take Baghdad, and there was a lot of concern about that. They were coming down the Tigris River Valley from the north down south towards Baghdad, and they're coming from west to east in the Euphrates River Valley. So that was a valid concern in doing that. The fight against ISIS, though, that's a little bit more complex in that ISIS invaded a sovereign democracy of Iraq. It was a democracy that we helped set up. Could we stand by and allow that to happen? That was the question. Mm-hmm. And for a while there, we did, as we thought the Iraqis could certainly handle that. But they were so demoralized and were in need of help, especially equipment, training, and our airstrikes. And so within 6 weeks, like I said before, we were able to actually give them that help. But there was reluctance in the administration. I mean, President Obama was elected to end wars. So mm-hmm. he wanted us to get out of Iraq. He did that in 2011. He wanted to get us out of Afghanistan. So very reluctant to join in this fight against ISIS. And one thing that's also in the book is we had to convey that ISIS was an existential threat and definitely was a clear and present danger that we were going to have to deal with either there or deal with it elsewhere in the world.
Well, and there were a couple of incidents that occurred that you mentioned in the book with their terrorists, in France and other places, were executing attacks on civilians, and that kind of got our attention.
Yes, there were ISIS-inspired attacks. Yes. Or actually done by ISIS. Either ISIS inspired or ISIS actual fighters were involved.
Mm-hmm. Going back to Wes here, when you're trying to do these missions, you're talking with people that speak a different, not only do they speak a different language, but they also have different loyalties. How were you able to be convinced that the information you were getting was truthful?
You know, largely a team effort with our, in the case of the, we'll go to the, it's a little different in each scenario, you know, in each mm-hmm. combat theater, but we'll go to the initial strike cell operations in Iraq in 2014. We had special forces teams, you know, about 12-man Green Beret teams at the Iraqi operations centers, where all the Iraqi generals and field grade officers sat running their forward troops on counteroffensives against ISIS. And so those guys also had an interpreter with them, and they were the ones, they were our conduit between our ground forces and us. We also had General Petard, who was often in direct cell phone contact with his interpreter, Ali, with some of the forward ground commanders. And so that was immensely helpful. But it was still incredibly difficult sometimes because you had to go from a forward commander who could be lieutenant on up, you know, to major or higher level, who most often didn't speak English. He's coordinating back with his command sitting there in his operations center with our special forces team and our interpreter. And then that information goes through them and then back up to us at the strike cell, and it in reverse goes back down. So it was incredibly complex. There was just a whole lot of moving parts, and you had to be really careful, really diligent to vet your strikes. Even in cases where we had direct firefights going on, where we were watching our Iraqi forces get shot at,
mm-hmm.
because sometimes you could think, "Oh yeah, I know exactly who's who when I'm watching this screen," but you don't always. You have to really rely on those reports from the ground, especially as maneuver forces are moving so much, which, as you know from your experience in Vietnam, they do.
Yeah, yes, they do. General, you in one of my favorite parts of the book is where you're trying to convince the Iraqi military to actually take action and go on the offensive, and they're a little bit hesitant to do this. And, and everybody in the – seemed like at the upper levels of the Iraqi command, you know, would almost call you individually and say, okay, I need you to bomb this area. I need you to strafe this area. How did you finally get them to – work together as a team?
In many ways, it was a lot. In many ways, it was a lot of patience, but it was also playing upon, you know, their loyalty to their country, their fighting spirit, which I believe that many of them still had, and it was also to make sure that they knew that they could trust us, that we would be there, and that's one reason why during specific operations that we had planned out with the Iraqis, that I would seat myself in the strike cell to ensure that they got the support they needed. Because oftentimes, you know, at every organization, you can be a little risk averse, so you don't want to be too close.
Mm-hmm.
I trusted Wes Bryant and our JTACs and our special ops JTACs that they could get these missions in and get them in very close and not hurt the Iraqi forces, but kill the enemy. But at some times they were very, very close as far as risking, you know, and I got calls on that from our CENTCOM and coalition chain of command. And another thing that you mentioned as far as the complexity is Wes Bryant and the JTACs also had to deal with coalition aircraft from all sorts of different nations, whether it's French, Belgium, and other nations that didn't necessarily speak English all the time very well.
Right.
And had different rules of engagement in proceeding. So that also added another complexity to what was going on. But one of my key roles was making sure the Iraqis fought and that we had the trust between us, and that meant that we had to deliver when we said we were going to deliver.
Mm-hmm. And then they throw in the idea of the Russians and the Iranians into the mix.
Yes. In fact, there was one fight near the town of Amerli, where you had three different forces from the from the north going into Amberley, from north down to south, was Curtis Peshmergas with advisors from U.S. Special Forces. Mm-hmm. From the south was the Iraqi security forces, and they had folks from us. And then from the east to west going into Amberley were a combination of Shia militias with Iranian advisors. Very, very sensitive, because we wanted to make sure, obviously, we didn't harm any of the Iranian advisors either.
Right.
But it was also coordination, and we weren't allowed to coordinate directly with the Iranian. So we had to coordinate through the Iraqi security forces, who coordinated with the Shia militia, who coordinated with the Iranians, to make sure that we could de-conflict all sorts of things, because the Iranians were firing artillery. We had some suspected aircraft from the Iranians. So we had to make sure that was all deconflicted. Very, very complex. But it was really the first time, at least in our knowledge, that we actually fought with the Iranians or Iranian advisors.
I don't know how you guys did this stuff. It's amazing to me that you were able to accomplish your mission and that it's still going on. And I know, Wes, you ended up going back to Afghanistan for another tour there. This is part of the book, but unfortunately, we don't have the time to get into that today. We may have to have you guys back on. I hope you don't mind if I'm assuming that we could do that. Where do you see this with our battle with ISIS right now? What are the ramifications that you see occurring and under this current administration, General?
I heard some of that.
The question is, where do you see our fight with ISIS going currently under the current Trump administration?
Well, in many ways, President Trump took the gloves off, and really, I think in some ways, the military commanders on the ground were given a little bit more freedom of maneuver and decision-making. That's one thing. But what President Trump followed also was a good plan and campaign plan from really the Obama administration, and that worked. The caliphate itself on the ground has been beaten and defeated. But ISIS as an organization has not been defeated. ISIS will appear in ungoverned spaces in failed states like Somalia, like Libya, portions of Afghanistan, and other places like that in the world. We've got to be vigilant. We've got to continue to go after them.
I agree with that. Wes, if you have a final comment, we've got about 2 minutes to go.
Yeah, I'll say that, to hop on that, to this day, we've got U.S. forces on the ground with Afghani defense forces fighting ISIS, as well as the Taliban.
Mm-hmm.
ISIS is definitely not dead as a terrorist organization by any means. And I can say, we talked a lot about the terror that ISIS was, and I think we conveyed in the book, we were just so impassioned to do this mission when we saw what ISIS was, because we had both served since 9/11 in this war on terror, and ISIS was the worst terrorist entity we had ever seen. And to remember who our enemy is, because often we get a little convoluted back home, or some people do. You know, ISIS is terrorizing fellow Muslims,
mm-hmm.
In a majority, as well as Christian minorities, Yazidi minorities, and others. And so they're an enemy to all of us. Not just the West, and in some cases with some beliefs, Christian values.
Right. All right. So the fight continues. I encourage everybody to read this book, Hunting the Caliphate. I think you're going to learn a lot. I think it's a great, great story that's going to really help explain what is going on. If we don't pay attention, we don't know. So I want to thank you, gentlemen, very much for being on the program. You certainly are true warriors in every meaning of the word. Thank you very much. Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you both very much. Right now.
Thank you,
General and Master Sergeant there. I want to remind people, if you have any comments about the program, please go to our website, veteransradio.net, and leave a comment there so that we know what you think about the program if you want us to continue that. Also, sign up for the U.S. Wings jacket giveaway, which will be next week on our benefits program. And finally, we're always looking for support to help keep a website, social media, and everything else going. So until next week, you are dismissed.